Hello, I'm Mark Stein. Welcome once again to have you all with us. We are thrilled to have here in studio King Peggy. The book is King Peggy, an American Secretary of a Royal Dynasty, Destiny, and the inspiring story of how she changed an African village. And King Peggy, while she's been on this radio station several times, never live in our studios, which she is today. And King Peggy, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me today.
Or should it be Nana Amuna Afenye the Sixth?
Yes, you pronounced it quite well.
So before we get back to the backstory, I mean, this is, I remember reading this story way before your book ever came out. They had that article in the Washington Post when you first got the news.
Yes.
So, and that's, so it was always, I was always fascinated. What does that mean? Who is this woman? What do you mean she's king? So you grew up in Ghana. You only grew up in Ghana for a short period of your life, right?
No, I went to a high school in Ghana before I left Ghana to, you know, England.
And then came here.
And
you were in your village, but your family moved from the village you're now king of to the city.
Actually, I never lived in the village. We only go on a visit. We used to live in Takoradi.
Right.
Yes. So we normally go there, visit my uncle who just passed away. And also when I was in England, schooling, when I come home on holidays, you know, my mom takes me over to see my uncle.
So, I mean, even though you knew in terms of your own people that you were, came from the a family of kings.
Yes.
The last thing in your mind was...
Never ever thought they will ever one day, you know, tell me to be a king, not even a queen, because it's it wasn't in my mind at all. It wasn't. It never ever crossed my mind. So if somebody had told me that I was going to be a king, I would have said, "You are a liar."
Well, given the way you describe some of this in the book, is that the idea of being a king in a nation like Ghana or many nations, which are very male dominated. Mm-hmm. The idea that a woman would actually be at the head,
yes,
was just unheard of.
It is unheard of because at the moment we only have three women who are really kings in Ghana, and I'm the third one. But, you know, at the moment, most of the men still really, you know, don't want to believe it. So the male chauvinism is still there. But I'm telling you, we are very strong and we are really ready to, you know, take them on. And we are really taking them on.
And we'll talk about that. So... let's go back a little bit. You, your father, if I remember this correctly, helped you get the job at the embassy.
Yes, of Ghana, because his friend used to be the ambassador. That, you know, when I came on holidays from England and then I went to see him, and then he asked me, you know, we are looking for a receptionist, but I studied in England to be a caterer. And then he said, you know, why don't you come? You've grown up to be a beautiful woman and, you know, you can come by and be a receptionist. And I told him that I'm studying to become a caterer. But, you know, I love America so much when I step my foot on the ground here because the pace that they go, you know. And
you like
it
that?
Yes, it motivates you. Yes, it motivates you to do things and become independent. And I'm really independent. And then I said, this is a country I want to be to move forward with my life. So I went back to finish my catering school. So at that time, I had one more year to go. I finished it, and then I came back and I took the job.
So, and it, so you didn't expect to want to like this job, but you did like it, and you stayed.
Because I like the country.
What was it about America that really grabbed you the most as a young Ghanaian and British woman?
You know, it's like, you know, the enthusiasm, and then the people here, they really don't take things for granted. They're working and going and going and going. And I was really energetic. And, you know, that was my lifestyle then, so I tend to love it.
But also, I'd like to hear that in some senses from the perspective of a Ghanaian woman, because you describe very eloquently in the book the kind of history of Ghana, the history of the Fante people, your people, and their relationship with the British. There's something
there, yeah, connection.
Profound about your description of what it means to be Ghanaian.
Yes. Well, being a Ghanaian woman, you know, and if you have never, typical Ghanaian woman is very humble. And not to talk back when a man talks, and also to be, you know, really home making person and making babies, you know. And I'm not of them. I'm not.
you're none of the above.
No, none of the above.
But you were none of the above before you got to America.
Yes, I wasn't, because my mom instilled in me. My mom used to wake me up 4 o'clock every morning and say, listen, you have to be strong-minded and very powerful. You don't have to let anybody tell you can't do anything you don't want to do on this earth. You can do it. You can do anything you set your mind on. So I grew up thinking that I don't have to limit myself to so many things. I'm a woman. I can do it. And that's all it was ringing in my ears. And especially when I was going back to England, and she said, remember what I told you? You are your own. I'm not here. You are going by yourself. And it's another culture altogether. Don't let any man intimidate you when you are there.
In America, she was talking about.
No, in England, when I was going to England.
Oh, and you're leaving Ghana to go to England.
Yes, England. Right, so right, don't let any man intimidate you. If you know you can do it and you know it's right and it's a good course, go ahead and do it. And if they challenge you, just also challenge them.
So that
was all in my mind.
Where did that come from in your mother?
I have no idea. Because my mom also, you know, she's a woman that really set her mind on something, she will really go out. And since she had 10 of us, and when my father left her, she was able to build an empire.
She was a bit
herself.
Of a philanderer. And
yes, she did. And she was able to take all of us to school without asking a dime from my dad. So we really, you know, looked up to her as a model also. She was a very strong woman.
And you and your little brother then became this unit that looked after one another.
Yes, but I beat a lot of him. And now he's a grown-up, and sometimes he tells me, now you can't touch me. I'm old enough to beat you too.
Yes. But that was part of your coming up, was the two of you and that.
We are 10, but you know, I was very close to him because he comes directly after me, and you know, just because I was bringing him up, because I was also mentoring him being a boy, you know, and then we got closer than all my other brothers and sisters.
So everybody asks you this story, but it's important to ask. So here you are in the United States of America, a young Ghanaian woman working at the embassy, and then. Years later, you get this phone call that you, what was it, 4 o'clock in the morning?
4 o'clock in the morning,
one of the phone rings, right?
Yes. Well, you know, it was really amazing, and it was something like a bittersweet pill for me, because around that time of the night, if somebody calls you from Ghana, either they want money or somebody had passed on, you know, in an emergency situation. And I didn't want to accept the call, but, you know, it kept on ringing. So I said to myself, let me pick it up. Then I pick it up very grudge because I was very tired then, you know, and I said, hello. And then I had my cousin at the other, oh, this is cousin, you know, she's the one that I named Chrissy Limpompo. And, you know, he said, you know, Nana, she started calling me Nana. And I said, Nana, because Nana, it's a name given to a grandmother or a grandfather or a king or a queen in Africa. But I was none of them. So I told him, I said, why don't you give it to me straight? Because what is that you need? How much? You know, and he said, oh, no. I said, I'm going to hang up. And he said, your uncle, the king, had gone to village and he's not coming back anytime soon, which is a term used when a king passes on. So I was very sad then. And I said, okay, so what is it? And then he said, they pour all the libations by pouring, you know, schnapps on the stool and it has to vapor up. And if it doesn't, you are another one. And they had 25 male from my family. Very well educated and morally sound. And then I was the only woman that they added it on, which they have never, ever taken a woman as a king in my family for all these 200 years. And then they had my name there. So they mentioned all the 25 names. It didn't steam up. And when they mentioned my name, it steamed up. So they got their king. And they said, okay, we have to go and talk to her. And that's when they talked to me. And I said, well, you know, being a king in Africa, it's very hard because it's not like European monarchies where everything is on a silver platter for them. Especially in a small town in Africa, you have to really better their lives. And here is a secretary in the United States. How much do I make?
Right.
I have my other bills to meet, and I have to better their lives. And on top of that, I have to bury my uncle who had been in the morgue for 2 years. So it was quite a challenge for me, and I didn't want to take that challenge.
For two years he's been in the morgue.
Yes.
So there's a couple of thoughts I was wondering as I was reading the book. One was, why do you think your name was among those to have libations poured on the stool, which we'll talk about the stool in a moment, but why do you think that occurred? What do you think was at foot there? Because you said there was a rarity, almost never would happen with a woman's name being put on a list as a potential king?
At this present time, you know, sometimes it comes to me that this thing was bestowed on me by God, because it's not an accident. As I was pondering how whether to take it or not, and then I heard voices. The voice spoke to me for 3 days and then said that it's your destiny. Not every day it's a woman is called to be a queen or a king. So please, you know, just go and lead your people. So I think it was bestowed on me by, you know, a God or whoever the voice was. But I think I believe strongly that it was God who had wanted me to go. Because other than that, I don't see how. Why? Because I used to ask them. I said, why is it that you had my name in there? He said, Nana, we don't know. We just decided to put your name there. It's amazing. You know, that's all the answers I get.
I mean, nobody could ever come up with an answer, even all this time.
No.
These years since you've been king, nobody has been able to come up with an answer.
No. They themselves, they don't know. They said, we were discussing, you know, and then we had three sisters. My parents and my brother had three sisters. Normally, they pick it from the sister side. And all these three sisters, they pick each one's children, you know. And they said, we don't know why. You have a senior brother. His name didn't even occur to us. You are the one that it occurred to us. And one of them said, maybe it had reached a point where we need a woman.
Hmm.
You know, but strictly speaking, they have never been able to come with any better answer. So I thought, and I knew, it's the time for me to go. And then God really bestowed it on me.
So, I mean, and when that happened, I mean, you called your brother.
I did. I called my brother in Australia and I said, listen, now I need an advice, even though you are younger, but I need an advice. I said, they have called me to be a king, you know. He said, are you crazy? What have you been drinking? I said, I had a couple of wine, you know, last night, but this is what they told me. And then he said, go for it. Go for it.
Were you shocked when he said that to you?
Yes, I was. I was shocked. I was shocked because I thought he was going to say, well, why don't I go for it, you know?
I mean, that would be the natural thing.
Yes,
right,
yes, right. But he never did. And, you know, and also I consulted with a few of the girlfriends I have in my office. One was them say, oh, don't go for it, you know, it's too much and, you know, and all that. But I saw the looks in her face that she was really jealous.
Were they all Ghanaian women in the office? They
were
all Ghanaian
women. Yes. And then the other one, you know, Elizabeth, she said, Nana, go for it. It's not every day that a woman is born to be a king. Exactly the same voice that I heard when I was pondering on whether to take it or not. So I said, well, I will just think. And then, you know, I just made up my own decision from all the advices I had and then took it.
And one of those spirits actually came to you when you were driving through Rock Creek Park.
Yes.
On your way to the embassy.
Yes. They say that was on the third day. Because it went with me for 3 days. Inside my room, inside my kitchen, everywhere. And then, you know, that third day when I was going, and there's a little ravine, you know, by the Rock Creek Park. And then I was turning, and then the voice started again. Nana, it's your destiny. It's not every day that a woman is born to be a king. Go for it and help your people, and there are people to, you know, help you. So at that particular moment, I said to the voice, I said, who am I? Who am I? Who am I? If that's what you want me to do, I've accepted it. And when I said that, I sigh. And I said, you know, and my whole body became like as if an ice water is being poured on me, my heart. And then I became very content with what I said. So when I went to the office, I asked to see the ambassador because I was, you know, his secretary. I went and told him. And then he looked at me and said, are you sure? You know, because at first when I heard the voices, I thought I was really hearing this because I was tired from working too much in the ambassador's office. So I had wanted to see my primary physician to get a referral to go and see a psychiatrist for 3 days. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was really, really amazing. Yeah, yeah. That voice was so powerful. I don't know how to describe it. I wish someday you experience it, then you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So after the time that I accepted it and I told my ambassador, then I had wanted to go to Ghana for my coronation. So he said, you know, if you are a king and you are going to be a king, you are going to be a good one because you run my office very well. So that's how I...
I'm always curious. Did the voice, when the voice came to you, mm-hmm. the spirit came to you, did they come in a feminine or a masculine form?
It's not. It's none of
them. Neither one, right?
Mm-mm.
Neither one.
Very beautiful voice. It's not a male's voice. It's not a woman's voice. It's just a voice that I cannot really describe it.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't know, you know, every now and then I want to really sit down and, you know, say, is that my mom's voice? It's not. It's my father's voice. No. And I don't know what kind of voice was that, but it was a very, very strong, good voice that spoke to me for that 3 days.
We're here talking with King Peggy about her book, King Peggy, an American Secretary, Her Royal Destiny, and the inspiring story of how she changed an African village. It is this year's book, Maryland book, for the Maryland Humanities Council, and she joins us here in our studios at WEAA. And so, you know, one of the things that the one book, I should say, is called The One Book. And there's so much here that I questions popped in my head. I was reading it. You go to great lengths talking about the culture in the village and the Fenty culture, but let me go back to one thing that was important. You talked about the people pouring libations and schnapps on the on the stool, and you talk about going back to Ghana, to your village, for your enstoolment, right?
Yeah.
And many people know this, but many people don't understand, I think, what the power of a stool means in many Ghanaian cultures and in your nation as well.
Well, you know, we have different tribes. And each tribe that they have a royal family, they will understand because we have different way of doing it. But this too, all the past kings and queens, they have their spirit in it. How they do it, I don't know. But, you know, they have their spirit in it. And then they talk to them all the time. So when after my coronation, they asked me to bring mine. And I didn't want a big one like the past ones because I'm a modern king. And I want a small one that I can handle it, you know, if I have to beat it or whatever. So I brought a small one. And then after they did all the rituals, they told me that my stool said it will never drink schnapps. It wants soda.
Right.
That is Coke. That's what I was giving to her all the time. When I go to Ghana and we are praying, I give her Coke. And as I'm really progressing with my kinship where I have a very strong, you know, male, you know, spirit, I think that has really transformed into that, you know, stool too. So they told me one day that, Nana, you know, we pour the libation and we give Coke to your stool, and the stool doesn't want it, and now she also wants schnapps. So I told them, I said, that's what it is, because now I'm growing into this kinship, and I'm having a very strong male spirit, and that's what is there. So it's really amazing how they do it. I have no idea.
So but I was also curious about the power of the spirituality of the stool and of the beliefs in your village among the Fente people in Utuyam.
Utuam, yes.
In Utuam and the village itself. Could you describe that as well?
The power, it's something that, you know, being in America, it would be very hard to understand. But if you are from, you know, Ghana or even in Africa, you will understand it very perfectly well because it's some kind of I don't know whether it was there before even the, you know, Christianity came to Africa. They've been really worshiping this, you know, things, little idols like that. So they have all the spirit in it. By pouring libation, by talking to it all the time, it listens. It's so powerful. Like, you know, you're praying to God all the time. God listens to you sometimes, and, you know, but you may not get it earlier, but you may get what you want. But the soul of the power in the soul really acts fast. Because they work with the person. And I only have one person who is my linguist called Chiami who talks and communicates with them.
Now, I was going to wait till later, but since you raised this, I'm going to raise it now. That's Chiami.
Chiami, yes.
You know, let me take a step backwards. One of the things I thought about when the Chiami came aboard and also the conflicts you had with many of the men in the village and what went back and forth and some of the contradictions. You know what it reminded me of a little bit?
Yes.
A Shakespearean play.
Yes.
The stuff you went through with some of the people around you, the kind of the battles and the who's going to be respected, who's not, and what they did, the thefts and all the rest. It's very Shakespearean.
It is. And, you know, I remember one of my uncles that passed away. You know, when I took the throne, he was really set in his own ways. He doesn't want to accept me. And then he started, you know, trying to really had a problem with me, cursing me and everything. And he is the same person who had trouble with my past uncle that, you know, made him to get a stroke and pass on.
Moses, right. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Moses was trying to really argue with me because I took him out from the palace. I said, I'm renovating the palace and I want you out. And he couldn't believe it. And he said, well, this woman.
Because your uncle could never get it done. Your uncle could never get him out of the palace.
Within a day.
Right.
I did it within a day. I don't know how I did it. But I went to Ghana and I called him, and then we were having a meeting. I said, Uncle Moses, I want you out of this palace to a small room at the boys' quarters because I'm going to renovate it. He said, who are you to tell me this? You know, I said, I want you out. Before I know it, he walked like a little boy, packed his things, and then go to the small room. And so he wasn't happy. And, you know, his main aim was that he was waiting for me to finish the palace before he would come and fight me. And he opened his mouth to say it. And before you know it, they really, really killed him. He went to the beach and he was coming and he said he had somebody slapped him from the back and he fell. And that was the end of Uncle Moses. Yeah. They didn't give him a chance to come and really, you know, really abuse me. Or yes.
What do you think that was?
Maybe the spirit from the stool. Because my stool doesn't play.
Neither does the king.
Yes.
Now to go back to what I was asking earlier, the tsunami.
Chami.
What is the power and role of a chami in
Chami is the one that communicates with the stool. Chami is the one that understands them. Because to be honest with you, even if I'm in the room and then the stool started talking, they have a way of communicating. Chami will be the only person to know, because Chami has been doing this through infancy, at least at the age of 6 or 7. You know, so he had grown up with it, and they have got the spirit and everything to be able to communicate with the stool. So his power is the one that communicate with the stool. His power is the one that really understand the ancestral, you know, room, you know, whatever logistics they have in there. And he can really curse you by the help of the stool.
Curse you?
Yeah, curse. He can tell you that in this, because you did insulted Nana, you are not going to live that long. You are going to be sick for the rest of your life. And, you know, really, it can happen. So that's the power he has.
It's almost like the Tsami is a very powerful spiritual figure, but it's also like, in some ways, your court advisor.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
That's the role.
Yeah,
that
because I have
plays.
Other court advisors there. Right. I have, you know, when I took the throne, I had about 12, you know, elderly men. But Tsami was a powerful one because he is the one that communicates in the stool room to talk to the stools and all the other things.
Now, your relationship with the Tsami. It was interesting. I mean, it wasn't always smooth.
It wasn't. From the beginning, it wasn't smooth.
Right.
It wasn't smooth at all. My whole journey wasn't smooth. Because a man, even though I was chosen an anointed king, still they couldn't believe it. And then, you know, when I came, there was no bank in the village. They were misusing the family funds.
Right.
And then there was no running water. And they were doing all kinds of, you know, really, really little stuff. They didn't allow even the woman to even, you know, enjoy themselves. They intimidated them and all that. And then I came, who am I? Who is this woman coming to tell us not to intimidate a woman? Love them whilst you have them. Who are you to tell us that we're going to open up a bank while they are not used to, you know, having a bank and, you know, doing all kinds of changes, trying to take us away from the palace for them to be renovated and all that. So it wasn't easy. So we started meeting from 8 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, because in Africa, they tend to use that 4 o'clock because my mom told me that at that ungodly hour, the whole world is quiet. All the good spirit and bad spirit are all roaming about. And if you want to really advise your daughter or your son, and you speak at that time, and if it's a very good advice, the good spirit will take it and help you to really bring your children up. So most of the families in Africa tend to really, you know, have meetings with the family around that ungodly hour. And it's in my mind. So I woke up 4 o'clock and by then my co-author was with me. And then I woke up and then we had a meeting from 4 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night.
Oh.
Yes. And it was a battle. And then they keep on telling me, you are a woman. You know, you have to sit down for us to tell you. And I say, you shut up and sit down because I'm an anointed woman and I'm a king and I'm here to help. You know, so we had a big, big, big battle. And then I always win. And they fought me so hard about the bank, but I was able to open it up.
Now, I want to talk about the bank and the other things you did when you got there and what happened when you left and came back and found your orders and the money were not collected. And
yes,
you talked about that. But the fact that you're a woman and were made king of Atuam, it was transformative.
Yes.
Not just for you, but for the village,
yes.
For the women in the village, and for the men.
Yes,
I mean,
yes.
Consciousnesses began to change
yes.
in terms of these last, how many years has it been now?
Five years.
5 years of
yes,
your rule.
Yes. you know, at first they thought I was an alien from another planet.
I'm sure.
Because they had a notion that, you know, she's from America, and then, you know, American women are supposed to be strong. They've been watching a lot of, you know, movies where they have guns and, you know, stuff. And, you know, they said, well, she's from America, and she said she's going to do this and kill us, she would do it. And, you know, that helped me. And also being a woman in a village had really helped the women in the terms that I've been able to really, you know, help them by giving them microfinance to empower them, to let them know if you're a woman and you have a husband, fine. If you don't have a husband, you don't have to think that you need a man to be complete in your life, you know, because not everybody is born to be married. You know, and also even if you are married, you have to really be self-sufficient to be able to help your husband in case the man is sick, in case the man doesn't have a job anymore. What are you going to do? That's when the morals, you know, weak morals sets in. So you have to be really strong to have something for yourself. So I've been able to empower the women where, you know, from the beginning, the men were not happy because African man thinks I'm a provider. You don't have to, you know, really buy anything. I have to really provide. And that's where the intimidation comes in. Because if I'm a provider and, you know, I didn't give you the money, you'd be sitting down all day waiting for me. You'd be hungry and you can't do much. And so if I'm not here or if I'm doing anything that is not good, you can't talk. I stopped all that. I said they can talk. They can do a lot for themselves. So it's like the men are really not happy. But now that they realize that the women are doing a lot with the money that we had from, you know, 100 Black Women Coalition in California, helping them to have their own little places to, you know, sell stuff, smoking, fish and selling and bringing, you know, something to the table. Now they know that is good. But still, some of them are not happy with it. But hey, I'm not worried about it at all. I'm happy that the women are doing something for themselves.
I'm here with King Peggy. She's the King of Kwam, a village in Ghana, and author with Eleanor Herman of the book King Peggy, an American secretary, her royal destiny, and the inspiring story of how she changed an African village, which is the Maryland Humanities Council's One Maryland, One Book for 2013. We have to take a very short break, but don't go away. We'll be right back with King Peggy. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm here with King Peggy. She's King of Kwam, a village in Ghana, and author with Eleanor Herman of the book King Peggy, an American Secretary, Her Royal Destiny, and the Inspiring Story of How She Changed an African Village, which is the Maryland Humanities Council, One Maryland, One Book for 2013.
One of the things that, I mean, you did when you first got there was to ban the beating of women?
Yes, yes.
And bringing women to the council?
Yes. Because I realized that, I remember when I was growing up, one day we went to the village, and my mom told me, you see that woman sitting down there, one of the eye is really big, you know, and he said he was beaten by the husband. So I knew that they have that beating going on in the village. So my first meeting, I told them, I said, I'm a woman, if anybody touches a woman in this village, it means you are touching me and you have to answer to me. And then, you know, all of them were really looking at each other because they knew what I was talking about. Because sometimes a man will come home and then the woman is not ready with hot meal or something, then they will start beating them. And I said, if the food is not ready, you go and do your own cooking because he's been taking care of the children. Go to school and pick them up and go to fishermen's land to bring, you know, fish and stuff. So why in the world will you beat her? She's not your property. You're only married to her. That doesn't give you the right to do that. And if you do that, I'll put you in jail or I'll make sure that you are out of this town. And I was able to stop all that. So now the women are happy. And then when we go to festivals, they're also merrymaking because before they don't even allow them to dance whenever there's a merrymaking in the town. They really thought that a woman's business is to be in the kitchen cook and making babies. But I said, no, you don't have to make babies. You can only have one if you want. Unless your husband wants you to have 10, and if you have strength, like our mothers, you can. You know, children are good, but you have to look at your finances too. So,
and some of that, I think, just reading about your own life that you intertwined in the book mm-hmm. with your husband, William.
Yes.
I mean, that feels like part of it just came out of your own life mm-hmm. where you didn't mm-hmm. you found out for yourself mm-hmm. you didn't need a husband to be complete.
Yes.
You didn't need it.
I didn't need it because I tried all I could, you know, being a woman, because being an African woman, and if you don't have a child with your husband, you're a failure. And I refused to believe that I'm a failure, because I'm here with all this modern, you know, medical, you know, technology. I tried all I could, and I couldn't, you know, really have it. And the parents of William had wanted William to come home to be able to have a woman who would give him a baby. So at that particular moment, I said to myself, I'm not a failure. I'm not God. And if I don't have baby, I've done all I could. And if I couldn't, so be it. And it just went off my mind.
It felt like, though, there's section of the book where William was with you in Otwam. He came to visit.
Mm-hmm.
And he had started with his brother this hospital
business.
Bed business,
business, yes.
And you wanted to go to him to ask him to help contribute something,
yes,
to the village. And it was a very disappointing, you could feel in a sense the love you still had, but it didn't force you to do things. But there was a lot of tension there around that.
Yeah,
there
was a tension, because I told William, I said, William, I couldn't give you a baby. Now I want you to give me something. And what he said, what is, I said, you and your brother are having this hospital, you know, equipment, bed and stuff. My hospital need a bed, because when the women are going to have children, they put blanket on the floor and then put, you know, water on it for the woman to have a baby. And sometimes their head will hit the ground. And I said, you have, you know, a maternity bed where women used to have babies on it, and I want one. And the same old William said, I have to consult with my brother. I said, oh, no, he hasn't changed. You know, William hasn't changed, because everything he has to consult with a family member. So I never got that bed.
So, but you have built things in the village since then. I'm curious about what's happened for you and for the village since this book was written. The changes have taken place.
Yes, a lot of changes had come to place. I've been able to give them 7 clean potable water. Before, they were drinking from a stream that was really horrifying, that you wouldn't even give it to your enemy. Now, you know, they have 7 clean borehole water. And secondly, I've been able to help the children who were roaming about in my beach, you know, that doesn't go to school, to, you know, really go to private school.
You said beach because the village is on the ocean. There's a fishing village.
Yes, and
right?
I have a beach where they normally, you know, give my family funds. That's the men were using it. And they were roaming about, you know, doing some kind of things in the village while they are supposed to be in school. And we've been able to help 50 of them to Shiloh Baptist Church of Landover, Maryland. And some of the American people have also sponsored some of the children. And we also have a feeding program where we give them, you know, 50 pounds of long grain rice, and then about 4 gallons, big gallons of oil, 24 cans of tomatoes, and then money to buy fish to cook for the children before they go to school. Because if you don't eat and you go to school, you won't learn anything. So now we are draining all these things, and we were also able to bring doctors that helped them, you know, to have eyeglasses, because some of them were not able to see that well because of how they are growing. And also we've been able to send an ambulance last year to help them. So I've been able to acquire and done a lot for the village, more than my uncles and my past milkings.
Do you still plan to go back to the village permanently once you retire?
Definitely. When the time comes, I will know. But, you know, sometimes I say to them, they say, Nana, when are you coming home? I said, when am I coming home? Coming home, you won't get what you are having, because being in the United States has given me the opportunity to have people to help us. Because there are so many areas in Africa where other kings have been kings for so many years. They have not even been able to give them even one water, because there's nobody there to help them. But being here, you know, had also helped me to help my people. So now I call myself part-time commuting king, and when the time comes, I will know.
We're talking with King Peggy. Her book is called King Peggy, and it is the Maryland One book from the Maryland Humanities Council.
Yes.
Joining us here in our studios at WEAA today. And there's so much here to cover. Let me go back into history a bit, and mm-hmm. then come back to when you first became king and the trials you confronted in the village. You talk about your fascinating about the Fente people.
Mm-hmm.
You talk about
Fente people are educated, because when the slave trade started, it went through Fente line because of the coastal area, because the ship and the things come over there. So most of the Fentes Very humble. We don't like any aggressive situations.
You just call us a peaceful people.
Yeah, we are peaceful people. We are not warriors. But, you know, you don't step on our toes. We are not warriors. But when you step on our toes, we also, you know, chew your whole toes. And, you know, we like good food. We like family life. We really Christians and, you know, very peaceful people. And more or less like Europeans, because the British people, you know, came and settled in the Fanti area. And, you know, most of us have, you know, European names because they tended to have children with some of our, you know, women. And so we are more or less polished. So even if you go to Ghana, they said, are you Fanti woman? And they say, well, if you don't have money, don't marry them, because they will really give you all kinds of European dishes that you may not even have money, and then you'll be broke.
but you, when you talk about the Fanti people, I mean, there was an interesting little piece you wrote about the slave trade, mm-hmm. and there's all kinds of battles between, you mm-hmm. know, the Shanti and the Fanti mm-hmm. over mm-hmm. slavery, we can talk a bit about, but there was a slave castle there that was destroyed.
Yes, that's still, in Otuam.
In Otuam.
Yes.
That is just the ruins are there now.
The ruins are there. And people tend to go there sometimes, and they feel the spirit of some of the people that were really transported, that they expired, you know, died along the way through there. So people go there. But my idea is, after I have really finished my priority things, and then I will make sure that if I can restore some of it to be some kind of tourism attraction. But at the moment, it's in ruins. But they have Cape Coast Castle, Elmina Castle in the Fanti areas, that people tend to go there and look.
So, I mean, how would you describe how the slave trade affected all of that for the Fanti people, for Ghana?
To be honest with you, they've forgotten about it, and they're moving on with their lives, and they are happy that the thing is over. But, you know, I think because we are now, you know, we are not the generation that went through the slavery, so it's like a history. But they really don't worry about it anymore. They're just moving on with their life, and they really interact with anyone that comes over there to really, you know, interact with them in the castle.
One of the things that... I want to talk about some of the characters in this book, because they are, I mean, it is just to me fascinating what you went through with, especially the men.
Yes.
In the village.
In the village, yes.
When you went back.
Yes.
And there were stories in here where you were talking about how you came the first time and you wanted certain taxes collected around fishing, mm-hmm. and then you come back. They weren't collected.
Well, because that's when, you know, I got serious and opened the bank, because, you know, from the beginning, they thought I'm a woman. So they were just trying to really do what they want, because then I told them, I said, you ever thought that I'm far away, that's why you chose me, or what? I said, I'm really coming with a very strong warrior mentality. And then that's when we fought, and then I opened the bank, because I was really mad and I had to put some fuel in the jail for them to tell me what they did with the money.
So what was your real feeling though when you came back? I mean, it sounded from the book, you were livid, you were angry. I mean, that this...
I was, because it's like, here I am working as a secretary with my, you know, little salary, and then I bought a plane to come to Ghana, and they didn't do what they were supposed to do. They went back to their old ways. So what do they take me to be, you know, being a king, being a leader? You know, I have to show my powers. I was really, really angry, and I did what I was supposed to do.
Something happened at that moment, that and a couple other things I want to ask you about, that gave you, it seemed, a sense of what you had to do to ensure your power, to make people know that you were the king, that this is not a game for you because you're living in America.
Well, what I really proved to them was when Ekwo, my sister's son, was misbehaving, and to prove to them that even if my sister's son is misbehaving and I can jail him, then I can jail anybody. So I jailed Ekwo when Ekwo was misbehaving, and then that's when they said, oh my goodness, this woman is really serious. So that changed a lot.
So, I mean, you have people like Kwame Lumpopo.
Lumpopo, yes. That is not his real name.
That's not his real name.
I changed it.
I guess you, after what he did. Mm-hmm. But this is it. I mean, this is, I'm talking about people who stole money from you.
Yes.
Who then embezzled
yes.
money by saying he needed $800 you sent.
Yes, yes.
And then, it was only $300.
Yes. And, you know, all these things really made me to realize that corruption in Africa is very, very strong. And, you know, I have to do something about it. So I really expelled most of the men in my council who were really corrupt. And then, you know, had women in there. And that's when they said, oh, well, this woman means business. Because we've been doing this thing for so many years. Nobody has said anything to us. Not even the men. But this woman really meant business. And I, you know, I told them, I don't want to say it on the air, but I thought you read it there, what I would do to them if they really don't stop.
I read,
stop.
Yes. Should I read that passage charges?
Not to be in the air.
There are a couple of things in here you talked about we shouldn't read in the air, but they're very interesting. About the difference between older men in the village and older men in America. But so when you just said you got rid of a lot of the men in the council, and, mm-hmm. and so I wonder how, now that that's happened, how has it changed things?
It has changed a lot because those that I expelled really would like to come back, but I'm not taking them because I may have forgiven them, but I wouldn't forget it. Like Kwesi Limpopo, the family, you know, last year, I haven't been talking to him since that he tried to con me and taking a lot of money from me, you know, because I was new in the town and everything. And the family, they got it together with my councilmen and women, and they said, Nana, you are a mother. Now you are our mother. You're really helping us a lot. But, you know, a family dispute is not really healthy because Kwame Lumpupu or Kwesi Limpopo can't come to a meeting. But sometimes, you know, we have to let all of them come to a meeting. And I said, you know, as because of what you all are saying, I've really forgiven him. But he can't be in my council. He can come to a meeting as a family member. And, you know, that's what I have, you know, really led them to believe. And that's what is going on now.
Now, one of the things that you also talk about in the beginning of the book especially is kind of modern Ghanaian history and the democracy that is Ghana. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what most people don't, you know, we don't cover, American news and media does not cover Africa intensely unless mm-hmm. there's a famine, unless there's a war, unless mm-hmm. there's mm-hmm. a genocide, unless there's, and one of the untold stories is the power of Ghanaian democracy.
Yes. Now, because of the democracy, they have tend to take women. We have women parliamentarians, women judges, women, you know, doctors. So now they're giving the women chance to also help, you know, building the country. The women had say in the in what the Ghana is going through right now.
And the president of Ghana now, who came in while you were working, mm-hmm. after this happened to you, there was a shift in the embassy.
Yes.
Ambassadorial shift because of the election.
Yes, you know.
The election was very tight that people thought might have caused a rebellion, but
yes, they
not.
Even finished the verdict. And, you know, the president that came on before this one that came passed away. And that president is from my town. He's my subject, you know. And the ambassador was also, you know, the part of the party that won. And when I became the king, you know, ambassador left. And then the person that came thought you are a king, you know, and respecting the king, they don't want you to bring in coffee to visitors, do things and that and
right.
that. So they took me to a very quiet place. And even then, you know, over there, I can work as a secretary, but they have their limits.
So how does that contradiction work for your life back and forth between the level of respect you have now, not just because you were named king, but you've earned it in terms of what you did mm-hmm. have done in your home village. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you're back in Washington, D.C., working in a secretarial capacity
yes,
at the embassy.
To be honest with you, I've really psyched myself. When I'm going to work in the morning, I don't dress like this. Because if I dress like this, they will never be able to even ask me to type anything. Because they will look at my crown, they will look at me and then say, she's a king, we can't really ask her to do anything. So normally I go with an African attire, but I have my beads on to really let the people who will see me that they are from Africa, that this is woman is, you know, a king or, a, you know, a woman of a stature. So, you know, I just go there and then psych myself that I was a secretary before I became the king, and I'm still a secretary. So I have to really be humble and allow my bosses to be able to communicate with me and, you know, do the work as a civil servant because I'm earning a salary. And then that salary is helping me to be able to travel back and forth to Africa. And I don't want to be really disgrace my stool, so I have to do it as a secretary. So when I go back to Ghana, then I put this thing on, the power comes. And then that's when I really said, I'm a king here. So I have to lead, and I have to do what I have to do. So I have two personalities when I come.
So where does the stool reside? With you?
In the palace.
In the palace. It stays in the palace.
It never stays in the palace.
It never comes back to the United States with you.
Mm-mm. They wouldn't allow me to come with. Even the crown, the real gold that has been in the family for 200 years, and the jewelry, the gold, they would never let me travel with it. So everything is in the palace. So
take us back then. Tell us the story of the founding of the village in the late 1700s. How did that happen?
Well, you know, my uncle that found the village, from what I heard and from what my mother told me, he was a hunter from another village. And then, you know, he was hunting, and he came to Utuam. And then when he came to Utuam, then he fell in love with Utuam. And then he stayed there and then, you know, went and told his other family members, and they all came to build a village. And then whilst they were there, another family that is in Utuam that keeps on fighting us. And this family, one of them was also, you know, somebody that sells stuff and came and then sold some stuff in the village to my family. And then, you know, it was raining and they couldn't go back. And then they asked my uncle, can you give us a place to stay? And then he did. And before he knew it, after the man had left, he brought all people from their village to come and attack my people. So they all scattered. So the name Otuam means they took me unawares whilst I'm asleep. That's the meaning of Otuam. They were asleep. They came and fought them. And my family members were really, really not warriors. So they were afraid. Some of them traveled to different, you know, areas. And these people took over the place. But now we're able to really get our land. But they are still with us because they have children and all that. So they're also in Otuam.
So the people of Otuam today are intermingling of both those people.
Yes. Yes. So we have different clans now. Mine is Ibirazi royal family, and they have Anana family and other families that are also there. So we are all living peacefully, but we really own the land.
So and the have the kings always come from some larger part of your family?
Yes, yes.
That's how it always works.
Always works.
And how does that work in terms of the rule of the king in your village and the parliament and the government of Ghana?
Well, in Ghana, you know, when it comes, they call us traditional rulers.
Right, right.
We have to be very neutral when it comes to politics and government.
You don't get involved in politics in Ghana?
No, we don't get involved in politics. They tell you not to get involved in politics because we are neutral people. When we get in touch with government, it means maybe we want our road built for us and then we can't afford it on our own. The government has to come to our aid. You know, little stuff like that, you know. And when it comes to politics, we don't, you know, really go there.
So that's interesting. So what you control really are inside of the village are the disputes between people, mm-hmm. things around land, mm-hmm. marriage, families. Mm-hmm. That's what you...
Yes. We have a police station in the village. And then when, you know, somebody does something, we take the person to police station and then they would take them to court in Accra. When I go, I really sit down and, you know...
Accra being the capital of Ghana, for those
who
don't know.
Yes,
right, right.
And then when I go, I can settle issues like marriage, land disputes. And, you know, the only thing that I can't really judge on is when somebody kills somebody. That's a big issue. That one, we have to let them go to the Supreme Court or wherever they would take it.
But that's not a common occurrence.
No, it's not. Not in Utuam. They are very peaceful people. They will fight today. Before you know it, they are all sitting down eating again.
That's one of the chapters you talked about, this huge battle you had with a bunch of the different men.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, some kind of ferocious battle, which you can describe to us.
Yes.
But then in the end, you describe
that. They will talk. They will come, you know, like, you know, we are having a meeting and then they will be very, you know, at a loggerhead with each other, fighting and, you know, talking against each other. And then after the meeting, you go out there, you see them sitting down there drinking and eating.
So as an American citizen, which you are.
Yeah.
And you hold dual citizenship, right?
I don't want to do the dual citizenship right now because I want to be an American, and that's how I'm going to be, you know, because so dual citizenship, it means you have two countries.
Right.
And then, you know, when, for instance, I go to Ghana and there's a problem there, the Americans are coming to be rescued. They won't rescue me because you have dual citizenship. So I'd rather stay here and do what I have to do.
So talk about how this you're writing this book has affected your ability to do things where in Atuam.
Well, writing this book had really helped me because most of the proceeds has also helped me to help my people. And, you know, I just really relate to them. And reading the book, it helps me to know what I've achieved and what my next, you know, goal is going to be. So the book had really helped me a lot.
So what do you think it will allow you to accomplish in the coming years?
The coming
years that you haven't been able to do right now.
Well, you know, even if you go this year, there's no laboratory in the community, and you know, we're going to build them one because somebody had donated money for me to go and build a laboratory. She's going with me, and then the reason being that the Americans have started going to see this village. They say, who is this woman? Because my book has really gone.
Yes, it has.
Because somebody told me that Alitalia arrived in Ghana and almost everybody in the plane has my book because it's in Italy. And, you know, when they come, big buses have started going to Atuam to see who is this woman, because a woman came and then still staying away and doing all these things for these people. And there is no laboratory in the village. Except, you know, you go to the houses, and I don't know how good it is. And, you know, for them to come and they want to go to the bathroom and they can't get any place to go and urinate or whatever would be really, you know, embarrassing. It means they have to rush to the seaside or to the bushes, you know. So we are going to build them laboratory, and then I want to build a fisherman's wharf and also make sure that the roads are really good, because when I was coming last year, I saw that the government has started, you know, trying to, you know, pave the road. And, you know, really help us and also make sure that the women are still being empowered and then the men are happy with them and the children are going to school and for them to be happy and be a modern little town in Ghana.
So I'm curious, is Chami is the same person still the Chami?
Yes. You know, Chami is getting new sons lately and he's 89.
That's what she
Yes, he's 89 and he's getting new sons, you know, because I think, you know, he's growing and he doesn't seem to really understand anything. And I'm trying to find somebody that will replace him. So we're working on it. Yes.
Maybe be a woman.
I wouldn't mind. I've suggested that. So when I go this year, they will give me an answer. And then we look for the person. I'll be happy. I'm telling you, I will be.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I will be.
Well, when you
I
come back, be. We'll have to find out whether yes. the Summer is now a woman.
Yes. And they have never heard of a woman who is a Chiami, but I'm going to change that.
That's what I mean. We're here. We've been talking here on the Mark Steiner Show with King Peggy. She, an American secretary, her royal destiny, and the inspiring story of how she changed an African village that she's written. And it is now Maryland's one book for the Maryland Humanity Council. And she graced our studios here today to talk about her life, her book, and this one book that all Marylanders are reading. So, King Peggy, Nana Amua Afenye VI, thank you for coming to our studios.
I do thank you all very much, and I want the American audience to know that we all have callings on this earth, and be ready and ready to accept it, regardless whether you are a woman or a little girl or what. You have to be ready.
Thank you, King
And
Peggy.
God will be on your side.
Thank you. You can see King Peggy tonight at Montgomery College in the Cultural Arts Center Auditorium. That's at 7995 Georgia Avenue in Silver Spring. You can also catch her at the Baltimore Book Festival's Literary Salon on Saturday at 1 p.m. That's in Mount Vernon Square here in Baltimore. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. For WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.